San Francisco.
Yeah, I was saying that in the mid-60s, when I was at Stanford getting a master's degree in painting, I was doing what could be called Bay Area Neo-Dada, which was a position that was more or less attacking principles and traditional notions of painting. And I'm suggesting that that groundwork, that early period of looking at art as something you wanted to extend by disproving what was current, or you wanted to find problems with what was being presented to you as important. In other words, the tendency was to undermine and hopefully find alternatives and extensions by not necessarily believing what was being presented to you as valid. So the painting was involved characteristics of forced primitivism, where you would make something look really pretty horrible in the painting. Certainly, a spatial notions of like the golden rule of division was aborted, and awkward spatial things would occur on the painting plane, and again, this idea of bad painting was what was behind this. And I'm suggesting that was a good foundation for what came later in conceptual art, because conceptual art was also abrasive to much of what had come before, and it was also very much trying to extend things and disprove others.
Yeah. So in a sense, that was basically your view of conceptual art then, in a sense, as opposed to the idea that of the idea having primacy over the material product, which is obviously a part of it, but...
Mm-hmm. Like during critiques in 1966 at Stanford, one could bring in a painting, and then the whole class would critique it along with the faculty. And so if you brought in a painting with maybe an image in the corner, and just a field of color, there could be the tendency for one of the professors to say something like, "I don't know what I think about an idea. So what's going on there is that Bay Area sensibility is very much wrapped up in virtuosity and fluidity of paint handling and visual vocabulary. So if you're presenting an idea about something, then they were already not sure if they wanted to deal with it. So you could say, although I never have said this before, and I've never thought about it, when I think of conceptual art, I think of 1967 and 8. I don't necessarily look back at this period in grad school the occasion for me to lay down central notions about conceptual art. I was involved in ideas as much as you could in this sort of studio work within the painting vernacular, but I was not really engaged in the perceptions that fed the work from 68 that developed into land art. That was another step for me that I hadn't really taken then, but I was beginning to operating with ideas. Conceptual, I mean, we often talk about 68 because it's when many, many, many artists sort of had this almost religious experience. Some before, some after, but the notion that really there was an alternative approach to sculpture. So much of this this momentum came from minimalism. You know, in Stanford, I mean, I wasn't doing minimalism, but I was very interested in the theory. I was doing a lot of reading. This is another important thing. You had extraordinarily good articles coming out at that time in
on art.
Yeah, okay. By yeah. artists and others.
That's
but
right.
Yeah, the art form was coming out with extraordinarily clear and catalytic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just fired your imagination.
So you had Smithson
and
Mel
Morris was doing his notes on sculpture, and Michael Fried had written this important thing on theatricality. I mean, there's so much stuff, and minimalism. When you're a student, or at least my experience was that you're really focusing on the current situation, and you're trying to really understand it, almost like a coursework.
Mm-hmm.
I felt obligated to really know, to really scrutinize what was happening, current work in New York and elsewhere, and really be able to establish opinions and deep feelings about what I thought about these things. So minimalism was a target because that was the current work in 1966. That's when these extraordinary works were being exhibited, like Carl Andre and others, then with this sort of desire to try to push the boundaries. How do you push beyond, like Carl Andre's floor piece, for instance? I mean, it gave you a target, it gave you
right.
a program. So conceptual art, partly, I think, in the hands of a number of these people, because I know we've often talked about that period of minimalism as being catalytic, something they either were inspired by or worked against or had to find an alternative to.
So then the form in your work, what form did minimalism take? I mean, it was conceptual minimalism.
Right. Well, yeah, but the early land art pieces were quite were minimal in the formal sense. I mean, they were not expressionistic. They often involve just simple cuts, lines that had to support a complete work in themselves. They didn't want to be constructivist. A lot of things that minimal art didn't want to be, land art didn't want to be either. And but one always sensed, and perhaps not correctly so, that land art was transcending minimalism. Because it so dynamically sidestepped the interior space and the object. And that was an overwhelming kind of difference, is when you cut a line, a configuration, even if it's just a rectangle in a wheat field or dug it into the ground, you were doing something far more different than exhibiting a discrete object or a simple polyhedron in a gallery or some of these early Judd forms. I mean, it was far more kind of, the potential seemed to be far greater. because it was in the real world and outside the gallery. And of course, that's what eventually created this sort of dependency on photography, was the fact that nobody could see it.
And that it's not the same as a photograph.
Yeah, well,
and then it's
see,
a different kind of work.
That's strange thing that might be interesting to talk about is the peculiar way that I can't speak for the rest of them, but the fact that you would never admit then that you, even though you were showing a photograph in a gallery, that you were a photographer. You just say that, well, fortunately, it was almost apologetic. It was like, well, I did this large piece out in the snow, I had an Instamatic camera, and I took a picture, and here it is. Mm-hmm. And they'd say, well, are you a photographer? And I said, no, I'm not a photographer. And then if they were really like aggressive, they'd say, then why do you show photographs? And I wasn't totally equipped or prepared to engage that discourse with any conviction. I mean, I kind of was a bit of a slacker on upholding some kind of critical mass about my position on photography and whether or not the art was in the actual work or is a photograph important. But oddly enough, the photograph is what became. I mean, land art, for instance, is very influential for art, for sculpture, and body art is very influential for art. But the photograph is what seems to be extraordinarily potent as what we're faced with today in conceptual art, and that was not important then. It was right. Invented then. Conceptual photography didn't exist. I mean, you could say that maybe you could pick a few photographers, certainly Man Ray and others, and say, well, there's obviously conceptual stuff going on here. But what we know is conceptual photography did not exist until that work was done.
So presumably in that sense it was informational. It was to tell you what had been there.
Yeah.
It was descriptive.
Yeah. And then I started to include maps. I would show a photograph of the piece and then I would show a map of where it was and then a text, like what it was. And it was my position was that this is just matter of fact. There's no aesthetic there's no aesthetic weight in what size these photographs are. Mm-hmm. But often I would be pushed around a lot by the viewers and questioned. I think second generation conceptual art that really use the photograph, like people like Barbara Kruger and Cindy Sherman and Sherry Levine and others were really quite different than the first generation because I think they really did look at the photograph as a point of departure.
So from there, then body art, and also you did things with mental images, really, right? I mean, trying to. What were you trying to do there? And
well, land art. The idea of doing sculpture by removing dirt from the ground and making a negative thing that couldn't be moved or bought or exhibited was extremely exciting. And then to use different surfaces in different parts of the world on the borders mm-hmm. of countries that maybe having a war, I mean, it's just rich with. It just seemed to be an endless stream of possibilities. So at that point, I thought I could be in this the rest of my life. I thought I could be involved in this kind of work exclusively.
How could you make a living?
Well, there's always ways. I was being asked to lecture and stuff. Actually, you know, when one had a show then, even of photographs or models, or maybe you would even try to execute some success, some tangible kind of earth thing in the gallery. The idea of selling was never even mentioned. I mean, which is, and it's funny how that carries over. You know, if that's the way art was introduced to you, or that's when you surface with that kind of sensibility, it never seems to leave. You know, you just, sure, you have to make a living, but it's not, it's so different than scrutinizing the objects to the extent where they're the value and all that,
right,
is really prepares you for the exhibition. This conceptually based exploratory work, going into the real world and executing, activating projects which were then retained somehow on film and may perhaps not, was extremely seductive. Body art. Because they say, well, how did land art fade into body art? Talk about seductive. I mean, see, I think what I was looking at was radicality. I mean, I wasn't looking at, okay, there's land and now there's the body. It was more art and what's going to seduce me because of the sheer radicality of the position. And body art was extraordinarily seductive because it was so defiant of the object, and it made so much sense once you started to deconstruct what you were doing on film, like maybe pressing a fingernail into your thumb and making an indentation, and you kind of looked at your finger as maybe the tool, but you weren't holding a tool. Mm-hmm. And it was so economical, the fact that you were making this impression without any extraneous material. So, I mean, as you began to deconstruct this, mm-hmm, and feed it and reference it in terms of art historical studio methodology, it became very rich and real, sort of made so much sense. I mean, it just had this rightness about it. So I was exposed to things that would challenge and enrich the sort of substance of the work. So the land art gave way somehow to, mm-hmm, the body work, partly because activities, problems, scrutinizing things and recording them in film and video or what have you, was certainly much more available because you were always with yourself. I did this piece with a dog once at, mm-hmm, the clock tower called, I think it was Untitled Performance. It was 1974 where I had to get the dog through the ASPCA. And
is that the German Shepherd?
And lay it on the organ. And you know, when I was dragging it in there...
You dragged it through flour or something?
Well,
was that what?
It was graphite. Mm-hmm. You know, but I had it in a canvas bag and I was preparing it and you couldn't see it. And I think it was Laurie Anderson was there that day, and she stepped on the bag and she just about fainted because it's kind of, you know, when you step on a dead animal that's just died. I mean, right even before it was made, it had this sort of story building, mm-hmm, up about it. This artist is dragging in this animal, and and putting it in the on this organ, and so that was hard.
So it was
to do.
The dead dog howling.
Well,
did the organ?
Yeah, I mean, the organ was, it was really doing what I thought. I had no reason to know that it would sort of play the organ. I just thought it would, and it did. But you know, it's funny. It was done on a Saturday, and it was publicized, but not a lot of people came. Like, really very few came. And but it was there, and it was there all day. And I didn't even stay in the room. I mean, I was maybe eating or something, or down the street. So nobody knows what happened, really. Nobody really heard it. I've never talked to anyone that heard it. It's funny. I listened for half an hour. I mean, I listened for a while, but I didn't stay in the room. I didn't want to stand in the room. I mean, it was this beautiful room that was just had this one door, and there was a high ceiling, and it was really quite. I was very happy with the way it looked and sounded, and everything was difficult in those days. I mean, everything was hard to do because you didn't have any money and you didn't know how to do things. You know, how do you get a dog?
Well, in fact, what was
taxi? even the organ, where do you rent the organ, and does it need an auxiliary speaker, and you know, where do you get the graphite? I mean, everything took months of thinking, you know, and nobody saw the performance, you know. A few people.
I think a couple of people told me about it.
Yeah, I never walked in and saw people there. One friend of mine came, he saw it, and said, you know, he thought it was much too visceral, much too heavy. I didn't know. I mean, I wasn't sure, you know. That's an example of an occurrence that happened often in that period, where obviously you were in the right place because you were pushing past your comfort zone. And this is good to do, because so much of your life afterwards is spent operating way within your comfort zone, too far in. And so when you're younger and you have this occasion to embarrass yourself or make mistakes, I think it's really, I look back at that as the best period.
Probably what wasn't documented in photographs too is documented in words. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is permanent document. It's not the same, but it is there, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we're talking about things that are were done a long time ago. I was visited by some French art students last year, and they came to my studio, and immediately they asked me to talk about conceptual art. And I thought for a moment, and I said, well, gee, why do you want me to talk about something that's so old? Yeah, that's 30 years ago. Let's talk about.
They just discovered it.
Yeah, I mean, it's so old, and you know, what about now?
When did you begin doing mechanical sculpture?
Well,
or was that all through?
The probably in the '70s, late.
Mm-hmm.
Late, not too late. Yeah, I think that comes from. You know, there's still this resistance, this residual resistance about objects that come from your first position in conceptual art as not wanting to make them. And one thing about objects, and of course when I say objects, I always sort of fantasize the traditional monolithic sculpture made out of bronze or marble. So And the feeling is that these objects really are often pretentious because they make big claims, and you try to give them the benefit of the doubt, but often you're disappointed in the claims they make, even good ones. So motion, movement, presence, even if it's partly theatrical, seem to be interesting to me because I wasn't blessed enough to make an object that had the kind of presence that people would claim could be bestowed upon it, like a Brancusi or something. I mean, I just wasn't going to make that kind of work. So the use of motors, for instance, the ones that kick the boot against the wall. This is relatively early 70s.
The boot was?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's very much an installation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, installations were probably invented during conceptual art, as far as I know. I mean,
well,
I know.
Well, didn't Jamie had Dali doing installations?
Yeah, I think we have to consider those, but not with the sort of the recipe and series of elements that inform installations even today,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to discrete sculpture. And installations, of course, were where you would go because, again, you were trying to get away from the single object, you know, the object on the pedestal.
Now, let's say the boot installation. I mean, that seems like a very personal, psychological
project, see,
right? I mean, where it's frustration or, you know, whatever you want to...
When body art went through a number of exploratory acts that were documented and then filed as things that you've accomplished, and that happened quickly. In other words, you got through the obvious things. In the summer of 68, the feeling was to get as much done as possible because
mm-hmm.
somebody else would do it. Yeah, the cat was out of the bag, and so you wanted to. You had Vito working, you had Bruce. You know, I mean, it's extraordinary people operating, and Chris Burden. And even though you wanted to claim that you were operating with an individual momentum and also a personal kind of. Perhaps perception of your art. There was a camaraderie. There
mm-hmm.
was a system of things that were going to be penetrated, and you could see them. It was almost as if once that door opened and you left your studio, all that was new. That you could attack. You could do a thing on the corner of a building, you could do a thing on a street, you could, you know, it's all there, you better hurry up. So the body art things, there were just certain exploratory things that you wanted to claim and have filed. And after that, you had to thicken the plot. You had to lay on other requirements onto the work to separate it from just being redundant and doing the same exploratory thing over again. So, Two Right Feet for Sebastian is about an amputee. Well, certainly anyone doing body art would eventually consider, well, you know, how about, you know, a missing leg? That's pretty interesting, the phantom limb. And so I was obsessed with that. I spent a long time finding a person that had a missing leg. And I was interested in the fact that if you, that leg, which is sort of supporting the body,
mm-hmm.
is not attached to the sensory system. I mean, you could actually start to cut it off. There's no feeling. And I was interested in volatile acts at close proximity to the body. It's like a flame very close to the body. And all these things would be referred to traditional sculpture. It was important. I'm getting kind of labyrinthine here. But you didn't want to lose your orientation with sculpture, because then you thought you'd simply be just too far away from the audience. Would not that you cared, but they simply wouldn't be able to get the link between past art. So a lot of this work wanted to retain some association with traditional sculpture. So having a flame next to a body, you would be reminded that the flame is what you use to melt material, melt lead, for instance.
Right.
It was a process that went into past art. But when it came too close to the body, there was an impasse. But what if you didn't have a leg where you should? Then you could put a flame there, you see. And that's what Lead Sink is about. It's about the fact that I'm melting lead, because I put a lead pipe there.
Right.
That was all videotaped. That's not part of the A show. And he was melting his leg, his support.
Was that a John Gibson? Would you show that Gibson along?
That was shown at Reese Paley in San Francisco. They had a gallery there for a little while. It was another performance that nobody came to. And though the five people saw.
But they still talk about it.
Right. They aren't sure what they saw. I mean, again, it was hard. I mean, it was hard to... You know, we publicized this and Lead Sink for Sebastian. And there was Sebastian, poor guy. I knew that I couldn't have Sebastian seen by the audience. We focused a camera on the lead pipe. It was very minimal. No one knew what it was. I mean, sure, they knew later because he came out. But it was just a pipe and the butane torch melting on video. And the video was brought into the room where the audience was. I have a picture of the audience, and I know there's only five people there.
Did he respond to it afterwards, after he realized?
This took tremendous preparation for me and for him, too.
It must have been very...
Preparation, yeah, in those days. I mean, you're going... It's like this film series called The Fugitive, where this guy is looking for a one-armed man who killed his wife. I mean, here I was looking all over for this one-legged man all summer of 70. To do this work that I knew what I wanted to do, and I was so focused on this thing. What did it mean, melting lead near the body where a leg should be? I mean, why should I care about that? We had Vietnam, but that's an example of the obsession and the sort of magnetism that some of these early pieces had, simply because you were thinking about them in relationship to art history often, and you were thinking that you have to do this. It's important. And I'm skipping ahead now. I'm in the 80s, and I'm talking about the factory pieces. Because that's what happened after the 70s in my hands, was that the work moved through the film, the documentation, the land art, the installations, and then it moved really back into structure. It's almost as if I could say, well, I did all this work that is really... doesn't even exist except through documentation, and it was about seeing energy itself as substance, even if the energy disappeared. in the body or something. And, mm-hmm. and so now it became kind of architectural and structural. But yet it still wanted to retain the association with the mental. And that's when I did the so-called thought factories and things like that. I guess at the Ace show, the snowman factory is maybe a little bit like that, but not as much as some of the work I made. This is an area of work that people know less about than the earthworks and the body art.
But today, is that true?
Well, I think so. They must, mm-hmm. because they aren't reproduced as much, and historically, I don't think the information about them could possibly. I think they're known here and there, and they've mm-hmm. been reproduced, and maybe, and they go back 20 years now. Time is really moving. So the early factory pieces were done in 1979. And that was very exciting. That's when I was associate, and I was still seeing Vito a little bit, and mm-hmm. things had changed a lot at that point, because we were moving into the 80s, and that's when painting started to come back. So everyone was feeling a little bit like maybe it's a good time to take a sabbatical, is what was really the feeling. The audience was not there.
Right.
Yeah, that's a strange feeling for an artist, I think, to find that the audience has moved elsewhere. But you keep going, and at a time when there was this other world opening up with this art of the 80s, was the time when I did my biggest work and most demanding work in terms of energy and organization.
Why do you think that happened? Were you sort of free in a sense that you had to do something else?
Well,
like
that was a mm-hmm. natural movement from the work I had done, and that was the opening I saw. I saw these giant structural counterparts to what we could call the mind, as being as rich an area as body art, which I think was certainly the richest area I've ever imagined. I thought they made so much sense, the fact that these giant structures were using images from the industrial world. They were sort of machine-like, but yet they wanted to remind one of kind of mental images and mind thought movement. And I mean, they were a little bit, I mean it was kind of hard to say those things then, because you felt you were maybe asking people to believe a lot, and take a lot for granted in what you were suggesting you were doing, where you really wanted that all to come from the work. You wanted the work to really grab them and maybe suggest those things. But the things that were being suggested were often very difficult to claim control of, to say that you're dealing with cognitive systems and stuff. I mean, it mm-hmm. just didn't, it felt funny, but yet that's what you're seeing in architectural structures, a lot of references to mental structures. And mm-hmm. but I was building big sculpture, basically. I mean, we forget all that and just talk about these big things, and they reminded some people of Russian constructivist work, which was fine. And some of them, they were reminded of Duchamp and the large glass and some of mm-hmm. these machines, which I felt was perfectly fine. But I did a lot of this work. I did a tremendous amount of this work, one after the other, in parts of America and Europe during 1979 through 1985. And then I started using fireworks. I developed this sort of feeling that the fireworks were ways of projecting out from these enormous structures, and a way of re-inviting the mental configurations that may have gone into them. So I would tell people that the sculptures that you were looking at were armatures for a second life, which was the reconfiguration of the mental idea that initiated them. I mean, the more and more convoluted, you know, it was a real time to get totally like entangled in this sort of stuff. But I think what was happening there, in a naive way, was a form of deconstruction of the artist's mechanisms, and like the fact that you were talking about this structure as being about the mental processes that made it. It was a kind of a cross-referential thing, and that comes from the mid-70s when a lot of bad work. That's when I did some bad work, I think, because by 1975 there was an exhaustion. There was so much so much energy burned up that and so quickly, and the one was devouring pieces and moving quickly and leaving pretty good ideas just there to kind of like whatever. And by 75 I felt a little bit up against the wall, so that's when there was this tendency to make your art about art making. In other words, it became kind of diagnostic, and I did soundtracks and installations that would talk about the artist and waking up in the morning, and I mean autobiographical, and it was tricky and dangerous, and some of it was okay, but anyway, it was that experience in thinking about the most important thing, the most challenging thing an artist could do would be to do art about the deconstruction of the mechanism itself, art mechanism itself,
right,
opposed to using art to posture or preface an image or make a social statement or probe some magical thing, but to actually deconstruct itself, and the content of what you were doing was in fact the interrogation of the act. So that's what some of those early machine things wanted to be. They wanted to be exposés of the trappings of mental fatigue and all this stuff that I experienced as an artist.
So it's in the creative process. How did the fire work, though, as an expression of that, when you were doing fire?
It was bound to fail.
Was it an electric current or something? The idea for it.
Yeah.
What was the equivalent of?
It was because... it was because there was... And this comes from the whole arsenal of distrust of past art. Amongst this arsenal of distrust was this one about cold sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
Sculpture that was, perhaps it may have been melted, and then it cooled down and then hardened and it was put into a mold, and there it was. The fireworks, okay, it was very much about, and the whole idea of creating an armature that would then project fireworks,
uh-huh,
was against that. It wanted to suggest that art that you're looking at that has cooled down and is hard and cold and absolute and not going anywhere was not what should happen. The art should be going someplace. It should reinvite this sort of temperature back into it. Of course, it could only do it for a moment, but it was better to have an armature sitting there that did fire off this this whatever we chose to call it, a map of the mind, or and then I made this big case for firework trajectories, rockets, as being like pencils. And I called them behavioral lines because they could hit another one and transact. So I said, well, this is behavioral drawing. This is not just, this is way beyond that. And then I even referred to them as notational, that they carry innate information. So there are a lot of claims made then, and there was a tendency, because this art was big and involve these volatile things, to be a little grandiose, and I remember this grandiosity of claim. You know, lots of artists do that, and I mean, it's kind of, I think it's okay for artists to be grandiose, because it's so hard to be an artist anyway. You may as well pretend that you're doing more than you are.
You probably have to tell yourself, or you wouldn't do it.
Yeah. So to feel that these things were in fact these extraordinary systems that were being divulged and uprooted and shown, that's sort of how one felt they had to operate.
So then it seems, but when did you do the puppets, the marionettes?
Yeah, let's go back. So we have to go back from the 80s to 74, and I did a whole series of what I call surrogates. And what I used to say then, and I guess I made myself believe it, was that that the performances got too dangerous. And I was using my children and stuff, and I said, well, they have to come to an end, the personal performances, the personal activities, the films that I would do, and these, they were becoming both a little perverse and a little dangerous, and it was getting more difficult for me to even want to go in that direction. So then I said, I'm going to make surrogates. I'm going to make little Oppenheims. Right. I'm going to make marionettes and subject those to things that I would maybe consider doing myself. So the first one was a bell, the one that hits a bell, a temporary cell. And that piece came to me over maybe an evening of thinking about this act in which a head would resonate the sound after delivering this extraordinary forward movement. And I think it was an attempt to just single out a condition that I didn't fully understand, but represented not dramatically the anxiety. I didn't want the work to appear to be, oh, the artist is banging his head against the wall because it's so hard to make art.
Right.
But yet it was about art making. It is about that. It is about the act and how difficult it is. I mean, if you want to really make art difficult, it can be really difficult. It can be so difficult that you really don't do anything. You know, I mean, you can make it like that, that there's just no way to do anything. So attempt to raise, and then the surrogates, I had somebody make a friend of mine came in and made a
casting,
actually modeled. I mm-hmm. sat and they modeled my face, which was great. And then we cast that. And with that, we made a theme for a major hit. I always thought was important. I thought the idea was important. I thought it was, certainly not every work you do you think is really important. Mm-hmm. Some you do, though. And I thought that was important because, first of all, it was this little figure. And I made these when I was a child. I made puppets. Mm-hmm. So I knew how to make them. Marionettes. I used to put on shows when I was about 12 years old. So, and then I knew that it would be a motor operating it, and it would be moving, and then I wanted it to move to a song. Well, that was pretty early to go out and find musicians and write a song. I mean, it was early. It was before a lot of that was being done. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was neat, and the song was nothing. I didn't know how to arrange a real serious thing, so we just had people come over and we recorded, and the lyrics were, "It ain't what you make, it's what makes you do it," and that meant a lot to me then, perhaps more than it should, and it probably means more than it does now, but it. I kind of believe that it was about motive, like mm-hmm. like what's really behind the act, like you know, you felt like dragging people to a table and putting a spotlight on them and asking them this question, like, why do you really do it? You know, mm-hmm. what's really behind it? You know, give us the real, you know, and you always would expect some answer like, oh, I do it for the money. You know, really be honest. So theme for a major hit was about the real impulse. And so when you ask yourself that question, mm-hmm. why did you do this? Why, often you would end up with an answer like the ones you didn't want to hear. Yeah, well, you know, if you want me to really be honest, I did it because, you know, somebody else did that, and mm-hmm. I think somebody else did that, and you know, maybe I'm not in control. Yeah. Maybe I am being manipulated. So then a lot of work that one did after that was trying not to be manipulated, and how to get free of things. And these are problems I think artists have at a very young stage, mm-hmm. I think. They have to come to grips with are they being, like really, are they their own person? And or does it matter? You know? So those works fall into that category of kind of beginning to go into the early, the mid-70s, when a number of those pieces were not successful. Then the table piece with the talking black right. and white, that's not bad.
How long is that table?
It's 60 feet long, yeah. So we've never been able to show
so
that.
So you could only show it at Ace, almost.
25 years ago, and wow. It's only been shown twice.
So the two heads at either end.
Well, yeah, right. they're basically, one is white and one is black, and they're trying to overpower one another. That was the original idea, and I came up with that idea when I was in Naples for some reason in 1974 or 5, mm-hmm. 5, I think. And then I did the lecture piece that's owned at the Whitney about the assassination of artists in a lecture. And again, it's a talking puppet talking about the future when somebody's assassinating artists and Soho is closed and mm-hmm. everyone's afraid of going out mm-hmm. at night and and the lecture is being delivered to an empty audience. So that was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but mm-hmm. the table piece was a little bit more... I wanted to give a serious attempt to sort of kind of the idea of taking color in these zones down the strip, mm-hmm. and one was black and like African American, and one was white, Caucasian, and the zones of the color and the voice, the drone, it's all computerized, but it just says black, white, dark, light, but mixes words and shifts them from mm-hmm. one to the other. It's probably, I retained that work from that period, partly because it was so difficult to make, and that I still felt it was after something important, even though it was something you couldn't capture and say that you claim you retain it. It was flirting with it, mm-hmm. and then the other piece, Gingerbread Man, of course, is quite early. That's 1970. That's eating the cookie. That's hardcore body art, where you're really dealing with. I mean, that's one of the things I talked about, is being a series of pieces you did early. You know, you wanted to be the first one to deal with making art inside your body like that. And so that was always important. And then the aging is a little later. That's a piece with the wax mm-hmm. figures. That was 75. That begins to flirt a little bit with these pieces that are maybe not totally successful. But yet I retained it because first of all, it's using an unstable material mm-hmm. in the gallery, and I like that, and it, you know, aging, everybody thinks of that, mm-hmm. and so I retained that.
You were pretty young to age then.
Yeah, you think about it constantly now, but then, you know, you're thinking about it, there's something about that was even on one's mind then. So
I skipped you back.
But those pieces of you know, we didn't talk about those surrogates. But I remember when I was dressing the puppet, putting the shoes on and the tie, I kind of like hesitated for a moment and kind of backtracked to land art when I was doing these really physical, tough, giant pieces. Mm-hmm. And I kind of said, God, this is, here I am with this doll, you know, this figure. And it seemed very jolting, you know, that how could I possibly, after doing that work, be holding this doll, you know? So it was, those things happen quite often in the kind of art that I do. You sort of wonder how you could be the person that did those, and now you're tying the shoe of a little puppet.
But you're very self-critical, aren't you? I mean, you're very, I don't mean it in the negative sense even, but you do keep reevaluating as you go along and looking back
and connecting. True. Yeah, but that might be a byproduct of moving quickly and mm-hmm. There's a statement. I don't think I made this statement, but it was attributed to me. Somebody else must have told it to me. It says, art Because art history is, oh, can I remember it? Art is what you don't know. Everything else is art history. Okay, well, so art is what you don't know. Mm-hmm. If you don't know it, if it is continuing and mm-hmm. continues to be mm-hmm. out there in front of you, it's hard to feel terribly comfortable about having anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard not to be critical of what you did, because you're really only looking at what you're going to do. So, you know, if you're going to make it that hard,
mm-hmm.
you know, then there would be a tendency not to really feel that you have to support all these claims that these works are housing things and really have established themselves as things. You know, you can be a little more critical about whether in fact that was important and so, you mm-hmm. know, so.
So from there, you started basically working on those houses, like with those architectural forms.
Yeah, well, that's bringing us up to the present.
Yeah, do we
a little bit? Yeah.
Do we jump too far? Did I
no.
skip a middle or
no? No? Well, there's a middle, but it's. I mean, I had to realize that in the mid 90s, and even in maybe like 89 or so, that because I took a short break in 86,
mm-hmm.
You know, it just took some about not quite a year, you know, it's the first time I had done that. That's when painting was really hot.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, maybe I could take a little break. And then I started to make these strange objects. Strange objects. I mean, a person who sort of came out of obscurity doing everything they could to destroy the belief in objects began. And my position was that issues are only issues when they're issues, when they're alive.
Mm-hmm.
There's no need to support something if time has eroded its relevance. So I felt I could do anything in 1990. So I did a lot of these. I would often equate psychological characteristics to an object, like a chair. A chair maybe having intercourse with another chair, and then. I would talk a lot about trauma. You know, I'd say objects, you know, traumatized, overload, too much information, and that would contort the object and make
mm-hmm.
it look a certain way. So I went through that, and then I started the large scale, more public art, which. I'm doing now, but with great reservation. You know. I'm doing a lot of large commissions with public institutions,
mm-hmm.
like airports and things of that sort. With, again, with a lot of hesitation, a lot of discomfort.
Because of the bureaucratic things and getting approval.
Well,
and
I'm not sure. I'm ending up where I wanted to end up here. Not that I'm ending up quite yet, but it's just such a long journey, and then finally I'm operating in a kind of a corporate, a quasi-corporate way, where the artist, I'm a romantic. I look back at the 60s when you're alone in the studio
mm-hmm.
and maybe you had a telephone, and that's what I really liked.